Welcome to the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast, presented by 13 Fishing Canada. Make your own luck. We're here to scratch that angling itch and talk everything fishing. Join us as we sit down with special guests from across the industry. Now, here's your hosts, Brandon Cater and Logan Lewis.
What is going on? Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. We have another exciting guest on the podcast. We have Chris Summers from the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group. He's also a biology professor at the University of Regina here in Saskatchewan. And just overall, a really, really smart, genuine guy that had a lot of information to share. But before we get into that, my name is Brandon Cater. If you haven't been here before, thank you for tuning in. If you tune in for every episode, we appreciate you. Thank you so much. I'm here with my co-host, Logan Lewis. How's it going?
Doing really good. My voice is back for this episode, thankfully.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a struggle in the last episode, but no, feeling good. We're about, what is this, pretty well halfway through the longest month of the year for us here in Saskatchewan, where there's no fishing for the most part. So, no, doing good. How about yourself?
I'm all right. Yeah, you got your voice back and I lost mine. So
yeah.
I'm a little raspy, but you know what? It's, we're excited for this interview. And, you know, Chris is a busy guy between, you know, being a professor at the University of Regina and all of the research he does. You know, I'm sure it's on his mind all the time.
Yeah.
Getting a chance to sit down with him wasn't something we were going to pass up. So, voice is a little raspy, but the information that we got from Chris is all worth it. So, if you guys are into fish biology, fish studies, if you are just curious about fish, this is going to be a two-part episode, two-part interview. So you can tune into this episode, episode 31 and episode 32 with Chris Summers. So much information from tracking fish to, you know, different questions from listeners about different depths and spawns and different times of the year, fizzing. If you're a tournament angler, you know about fizzing, kind of the mortality rates and things to look for with barotrauma. So much information from a scientific and, just curiosity aspect that you're really going to want to tune into this. So, but before we get into a little more details on our sponsors and whatnot, are you ready for open water? Like what is today? Almost halfway through the month of April, May 5th.
It's coming.
Are you ready?
No, I am not. I don't even have the boat out of the Quonset yet. We talked about in earlier episodes, we both got new Garmin units when they were on sale. That was big. So I'll be adding that. For people that don't know, I got, I believe it's a 16. I should know this. It's my boat, but it's 16 and a half foot Lund, just with the side console. So I don't know how much room I really have. I already have a Helix 7 there, which, I mean, it's not huge by the standards of lots of the walleye boats and whatnot that you see, but I'm also adding this 9-inch Garmin now. So I got to get the boat out of the quad set and get into the shop and take a look at where the heck am I going to put this thing. I still haven't really figured that out yet. I've been thinking about it, but there'll be some research. I'm sure some of you that listen to this that I talk to will be hearing from me with some questions, but no, not quite ready. And I still got, like, lots of my ice fishing stuff is stuff I use in the summer as well, so I got to take that out of my rod box and switch things over. So no, I'm not prepared. How about you?
I wish I wasn't on the same boat as you right now, but I am. And I mean, for the most part, I tossed away majority of my ice fishing stuff is packed away, stored away on the shelves and whatnot. Now we got this absolutely ridiculous blizzard going through. It seems like it's ice fishing season still because we got a foot of snow that's supposed to come through Manitoba, Saskatchewan here. And it's just crazy. You know, everything was kind of melted here in the southern part of Saskatchewan. And all of a sudden we had this, what the Weather Network calls the largest blizzard of the decade.
Last couple decades. But I would say it's been weird, right, for all this to be happening in April. But Maybe it hasn't hit yet. I mean, I don't know if it was supposed to hit last night. I know it was supposed to be more of the southeast part of the province and some Manitoba. I've seen some pictures of some snow and stuff, but like the way this thing was hyped up, I thought it was going to be like the apocalypse going on by what they're saying. So I don't know if it's lived up to that yet, but
I mean, I have quite a few friends in North Dakota, and yeah, within the last like 20 hours, they've got like two feet of snow. Like okay. It's pretty crazy. And like, right, parts of Saskatchewan are only supposed to get it like south east of the province. I don't know.
Those we're largies. Kind of
like, yeah, we're just kind of like on the bridge of it, man. Like yeah. Manitoba, I think, is supposed to get smacked pretty good. So
good luck even.
But yeah. And but yeah, for the most part, right, like I haven't even placed an order for like anything. There, I have some things I need to get. I want to get a couple new reels, some new line. I haven't even placed an order yet, and the way inventories are, you know, I need to get that done, and I'd like to get all my spooling done, all my rods rigged up, ready to go. Mm-hmm. May 5th is going to come quick. Next thing you know, it's going to be June, and we're going to be, you know, close to midsummer, and, you know, ripping jigging wraps and putting big walleye in the boat, and, you know,
maybe
the open season is going to fly by, but yeah, I mean, regardless, I'm super excited.
That brought up a question in my head when you're talking about spooling. Maybe if people want to shoot us a message, how often are you re-spooling your line?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think I do it less than a lot of people, because to me it's like some of this line, especially when it's braid, it hasn't seen the light of day lots of the time. Like I know whether it's tying leaders and stuff like that, like I'm always losing a couple feet of line a day just tying and stuff lots of the time, but like how often are people re-spooling? I don't think I do it near enough.
The average weekend warrior, how often are you re-spooling? Yeah.
What do you do?
I do it every second season, depending. And like
okay, you might be worse than me for it.
No. So like I'll like leave it on for like one season, depending on the rod too, and depending on the line. I was reading an article, I can't remember all the details, but like it has a lot to do with where you keep your reels in line too.
In the sun only.
Right? No, but like what temperature, and you know, it has a lot to do with it, and it deteriorates the strength of the line depending on the type of it and the temperature and whatnot of where you store it in the off seasons. Well, so
with the amount you snap off, it must be in a not great environment for that.
Yeah, probably. I mean, frick, I snap off more than anyone I know. Yeah. But that's just because the fish are so dang big. But
you're so strong too that you set that hook so hard.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah. Nonetheless, we put up a story the other day. Had a lot of people reply back with kind of their mid-season, in between season, I guess, preparations. And yeah, there's a lot to do. And I hope you guys get it all done before opening day.
Yeah, it's shed hunting season. I ain't got time to get ready for fishing.
I ain't got time for that.
I think that the thing about the order, kind of good transition into the sponsors, but one thing I'll be ordering is some more jerk baits. Kind of got on a cool bite in the spring at Buffalo last year. Kind of that hour before the sun's going down into like, at least in Buffalo, it was like hour before the sun goes down to about half an hour after. Walleyes are in shallow, just pulling those jerk baits through the shallows, and that was pretty cool bite. Like literally would stand on the dock if I wanted to, and I think I caught like four or five walleye off the dock, just chilling down there for like 15, 20 minutes in the evening. So I'll be picking up some more jerk baits for sure. That's item number one.
Any specific, like the Rapala Husky jerk?
Probably some Huskies. I was using mostly the rip stops, but I think I got the smallest size, and I think I want to get some. I think there's two sizes, and I want to get the, I think the bigger ones are 4.5 inches, maybe. Don't quote me on that. It's something like that. Whereas the smaller ones, I think, were 3 something. So I want to get some of the bigger ones for that. But just, yeah, kind of anything along those lines, like the Husky jerks, maybe not the bigger size, obviously Husky jerks, but no. So yeah, something along those lines. Definitely be some of those in my cart.
Well, and I mean, anybody listening, if you guys need lures, line, rods, reels, what have you, 15% off Rappella.ca. All nine brands. That's Rappella products, Storm products, 13 Fishing products.
Strike Master
products. You know, so many great products on that website. Save yourself 15% off. The code is Weekend Warriors. And yeah, code and link will be in the show notes below. I mean, go save yourself some money. So many great products. Suffix Line. I mean, yeah. Everything you need is on Rappella.ca.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that's a good one to start off. Of course, I want to give a big thanks to the Sask Wildlife Foundation, or Federation, sorry. They've been huge with us and kind of some cool projects that we've got to work on. So be sure to get those memberships. I know lots of the tournaments that you want, if you want to fish in the summer, usually are some branch that you will need a membership anyways, right? Like I know the Buffalo Pound one, like that's where I get my membership out of Moose Jaw. So I mean, that plays into that. So definitely a good thing to get. Comes with magazine subscription, some insurance, access to land and stuff like that. So definitely a good thing to check out. And it's only like $20 to $25.
Yep. And got to give a shout out to our friends over at Blackfish Gear. Tons of great products, soft shell products, bibs, jackets, pullovers, UPF, sun protective gear, rain gear, you know, springtime, you know, expect some rain if you're going to be fishing on the rain. Yep. Some fantastic rain gear there as well, too. Waterproof socks, gloves, toques, hats, you name it. Down below in the show notes, exclusive 15% off blackfishgear.com. You're not going to find that kind of discount on Blackfish Gear anywhere else. Go take advantage of it. You're not going to be disappointed.
Yeah, I'll be definitely wearing that. And though it starts to get so cold, well, it feels so cold once May 5th hits there and you start fishing into the evening there and it starts to get a bit darker, it definitely gets colder. So we'll definitely be wearing some of that stuff there. But I guess next up, we'll have a quick word here from Lucky Bastard Distillers. And then I think we'll probably just hop right into the interview. So hopefully you guys enjoy the interview and stay tuned for what will be part two, I guess, 2 weeks after this interview.
There are certain moments in life that really stick with you. This is definitely one of them. The thrill of the dill, my friends, is not a myth.
Prohibition is over, Saskatchewan. Ask about LB's legendary Birmingham's Dill Pickle Vodka. After all, it's not a party until someone pulls out the pickle. Tours and tastings available. Call or stop by 814 47th Street East. And tonight, why not mix your Caesar with some Lucky Bastard?
It's the one with the pickle in it.
This is one I've been looking forward to for quite a while. I was just telling Chris before we got recording here that he's been on our list since we started the podcast just around a year and a bit ago. So I guess without further ado, here's Chris Summers. I guess what can you tell us about yourself? I know a lot of us in Saskatchewan at least have followed along on the Facebook page, and you're actually pretty good about kind of updating about who you are and letting the people know. But I guess for people listening to the podcast that might not know who you are, just give maybe a quick breakdown of that.
Sure. So professionally, who I am a professor of biology at the University of Regina, and I have been in the department there since 2006. So coming up on 16 years now, which is pretty crazy. Prior to that, I came to Saskatchewan for a 2-year postdoctoral fellowship. So I was supposed to be here for 2 years, and that was supposed to go 04 to 06. But when I came to Saskatchewan, I fell in love with the place and obviously never left. I grew up in Southern Ontario, in Toronto, right in the heart of what some people might call the hood. And my dad was a cop. And we, you know, we weren't a wealthy family, but we had a kind of beaten up old RV that we took camping. And, I kind of got turned on to fishing early in life. You know, lots of guys get it from their dad. My dad actually didn't like fishing very much, but he was always willing to drive me somewhere and kind of boot me out of the car and say, okay, here's your fishing rod and here's the river. I'll come back and get you in 4 hours kind of thing. And we did that during camping trips. We did that in areas around the city itself. So I guess a summary of me would be I'm an applied ecologist. I have an interest in how people and animals interact with each other and how science can be used to strike a good balance in those interactions. And so that takes me down a lot of different roads with a lot of different critters. And obviously people love to interact with fish. And so there's a lot to be done in that kind of theme with fish and fisheries.
Right. So I guess I was kind of curious. So has it always been, I guess, from a professional standpoint, has it always been that fish based research that's going on? Or like you said, it's, I guess, between animals and humans, like, was there other studies before what you're dealing with now?
Oh, yeah. So, and still ongoing at the same time. So, my what gets me out of bed in the morning and excited about going to work is this idea that sometimes we get the short end of the stick. So think about, you know, wildlife management. And a great example I can give is I've worked extensively on double-crested cormorants, which are the bird that every angler loves to hate, right? That's the one that eats fish and causes conflict. And so, you know, what do we really understand about that issue? That's the kind of question that I really like. I've also done a lot of work on birds other than cormorants, so pelicans. I just finished up a big project on the provincial bird of Saskatchewan, sharp-tailed grouse. We do work on reptiles, so I work on bull snakes, rattlesnakes, eastern yellow-bellied racers. We've done lots of work on turtles. So basically, if it crawls, swims, flies, and interacts with people in some way, you'll probably find me hanging around there. Fish hold a special place in my heart, though, because that's really where I got interested in science in the first place, was as a young kid trying to understand why there were Chinook salmon in the Great Lakes. Was what really first tweaked that question in my mind about, well, whoa, what's going on here?
Right. Yeah, for sure. That's I think that's kind of something that lots of us have in common, whether we're just anglers or if it is like a science background, is we're all just so interested in what they do and I guess why they do it, right?
Oh, yeah. And I actually say that, you know, what some people will say to me, well, you're the fish biologist. And I always say, no, anglers are all fish biologists, right? They how could you be more of a biologist than trying to use your equipment and your presentation and your knowledge of habitat to find an animal and catch it, right? That, you know, that's fish biology. So, so anybody who tells me they're not a fisheries biologist or just an angler, I don't buy it.
No, they might not realize it, but all they have to do is start writing it down and they might turn that way.
That's right.
That's super interesting that you say that. 'Cause we had Shayna. She was actually our first guest ever on the podcast. And Shayna was part of your group, which is the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group. And so how did that, so you're at the university, obviously you do a ton of studies, but what kind of generated the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group? Where did it branch from and kind of what's the background on that?
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the evolution of that group. So when I first came to Saskatchewan, I was fresh out of grad school in Southern Ontario. I was at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, which is right on Lake Ontario, kind of an epicenter for cormorant conflicts with fisheries. And I had done a lot of work on cormorant diet and cormorant conflict in the Great Lakes. When I came to Saskatchewan, I wasn't quite sure exactly what I was going to do. I had kind of a almost like a, it's a fellowship that the federal government pays, and it's like an apprenticeship. So they team you up with a professor and you're supposed to get a little bit more professional experience on their dime, right? And so I teamed up with a professor named Mark Brigham at the University of Regina. He's kind of famous for his work on bats. Under his guidance, I was going to find an applied ecology type project to work on. And when I started chatting with folks here, it turned out that cormorants were just as much of a perceived problem in central Canada here, in Saskatchewan and Alberta, as well as Manitoba, as they are in the Great Lakes. There just wasn't any scientists really working on that topic. So it was a really easy shift for me to say, okay, well, I can bring some of my expertise to this. Let's start to work on cormorants. As that work progressed, it became more and more about fish, because that's really the height of the conflict there, right? You can learn all you want about bird biology, but really it's the fish side of things that generate that conflict with cormorants. So I began to work more and more officially on fish. And, you know, as a different kind of line of inquiry, I started working with tournament organizers and walleye tournaments and doing some work on genetic integrity of walleye lineages and whether or not there might be some hybridization with sauger in Saskatchewan. And as I was talking to tournament organizers and tournament anglers, they kept asking me a bunch of questions about what do I think happens to the fish after they get released, and what are good signs of a fish that's healthy and good to go. And I had some what I felt were sort of personal answers, but not a really good, strong scientific foundation to say, here's the answer to your question.
Yeah.
So really, really long route to get to the point where I started looking around as well for resources. You know, where can you find information like this when people are asking me questions? And it dawned on me that none of the post-secondary institutions in Saskatchewan had any formal fisheries research programs on the go. So we have our fisheries unit with the provincial government, which does monitoring and, you know, they make management decisions and that sort of thing. But there wasn't really a place where they could go, or where anglers could go, or where the Saskatchewan Wildlife Federation branches could go and say, we have this burning issue, this question, and we need some fisheries science done. How can that happen? What I wanted to do was to make that what I would call a research node at the University of Regina. So if there is a fisheries issue, that's the place that you would go and say, hey, you know, Chris, we have this problem with whatever. And if I can help, if I can generate resources, if we can put some science into it, that's where I want it to be. So that was ultimately what spawned the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group.
Right. Yeah, and I think now that you kind of say it's that node, it kind of quickly just went through in my head all the different studies that I've actually heard about that you're doing. Like, it's not just a one-off study of, say, like tagging the walleye and kind of where do they go once they're released. Like, there was, I know Shane was dealing with the Prussian carp. You've had the acoustic tagging. There's now the pike tip-up study that you have going on. So it's kind of neat that it's not just one issue. Like you said, if there's something that comes up, you guys can kind of look into it. It's not just one lane that you're stuck in.
Yeah. And it's what I would call problem-based research. So some professors and some scientists have this grand vision of, you know, a basic problem that they want to tackle, and they'll spend their entire career working on that one thing. That's totally not me. I guess I have scientific ADHD or something. Like, I much prefer the challenge of a tangible problem that someone comes to me with and says, we have this issue. We don't understand enough about it to make the right decisions in dealing with, you know, like I said, achieving that balance in the interaction or the outcome. And I love that challenge of, you know, scratching my head and saying, well, what can we do to learn about this and to maybe help make some good decisions?
Right. And I think that's, I'm kind of similar in the form of fishing, where I can't just fish for walleye, or I can't just fish for pike. Like, I need to, it needs to be switched up almost every week or every other week about what I'm going to fish for. So I can kind of understand that. But I think one thing that we are kind of curious of with the group is, well, I guess, how many years ago did that start?
Officially, we started the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group in 2016.
Okay.
So it's been about 6 years.
Okay. That makes sense. And I guess with would you say the biggest study you've had is the release of the tagged walleye as far as size goes for the group?
Yeah, so we do a whole variety of things, some of which I would call long-term or legacy type research projects, and some of which are very targeted and much more focused in a certain period of time. So the telemetry study on Buffalo Pound, for example, was one that we carried out for a 3-year period. And, you know, we collected data furiously for that 3-year period. The tournament tagging project is one that's been going on continuously from that time, mm-hmm. and will go on as continuously as possible until I retire, or they bury me, or both. Right. So that, you know, that you learn something immediately, but then you have that power of having, say, 20 years worth of data that you can look back on and say, you know, we've learned these big picture things as well as the targeted questions that we have. So
right.
In terms of dollar value and intensity, I would say that the telemetry study on Buffalo Pound was one of the bigger ones we've done. We also did a post-release tournament study on walleye using telemetry manually. So the one on Buffalo Pound was with receiver stations, where we put these semi-permanent loggers out in the water, and when fish swim by them, they get detected and it downloads their data, sort of like a cell phone network. Right. The other way you can do it is you take a hydrophone and you attach it to a boat and you chase the fish around, actually follow their signals and go right to where they are. And so we did that after tournaments in Saskatchewan for 2 years in a row, and some really hardcore chasing fish down and figuring out where they were moving to, which was also quite a big and intensive study.
Right. So that's like basically, I guess, I've always heard of it as the acoustic tags.
That's right.
Yep. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So what was the word you're using that I can't pronounce it? Starting with the T?
Telemetry. Yeah, telemetry. So there's two forms of telemetry we use. Telemetry just means using a signal to locate something. So okay. Telemetry, we use radio telemetry, which is basically you turn the fish into a radio station. So we put a VHF transmitter on it and it broadcasts a high frequency signal, just like a, you know, like a little mini DJ basically in the water.
Yeah.
And we use a radio receiver to pick up that signal and track it. And the information on the fish's ID and everything is buried in that radio signal. The problem with radio signals in southern Saskatchewan is that they don't travel well in water with high conductivity or high turbidity. And you know what our southern Saskatchewan lakes look like. They're not really great.
They're thick.
Yeah, they're more milkshake-like at times. So that doesn't work well here. It works well in the north, but not so much in our southern lakes. Acoustic telemetry is sonar. Right. So it is the same technology that submarines use to find range to target underwater. So nobody understands this anymore because I guess I'm too old and everyone else is too young. But the movie The Hunt for Red October, they use the sonar pings to communicate with each other in that movie. And I go around quoting Sean Connery from that with that Scottish accent all the time. And the students have no idea what I'm talking about. But
no clue.
Yeah. Sound travels really well underwater. And so if you send a sonar ping from the fish, it will travel long distances, much clearer signal. Doesn't matter about the turbidity or the conductivity of the water. And it solves that problem of the more traditional radio technology. So we use both.
Right.
And acoustic tags are basically sonar tags.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess for anyone that was out on Buffalo Pound before COVID, and they were seeing the orange buoys out there. That was you guys, right?
That was us. So I don't want to nerd out too much on you guys here, but if you imagine,
bring it on. Yeah.
So imagine this. You want to know where a fish is, right? There's these two ways that I've mentioned. You put grad students in a boat, and they have a directional hydrophone. It's a listening device, basically, right? And they listen for the fish, and they move towards the signal until they come to a place where they can, it's called triangulating, where you measure on different angles and you try to actually infer the position of the fish underneath you. Imagine how long it takes and how difficult it is. And, if you have personnel involved and there's bad weather or it's a Sunday or something like that, you have people problems, right? It's hard to get the hours that you need and to find the fish. The fish move all over the place. The Buffalo Pound study was amazing because we put out 22 receiving stations in the lake. We moored them to the bottom. And at each one, there was a listening device that listens for those acoustic signals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It never takes time off. It never gets seasick, right? It never, it doesn't have any of those people problems. And it can record almost an unlimited number of fish detections. So we would have fish that would swim through this network of receiving stations, and we get 300,000 location data points for that fish, right? And then you can use these awesome programs that will basically reconstruct the movement and the home range size and the lake use by that fish based on the way the system is set up. And you just can't recreate that with people. We just can't. We're not able to collect data like that. So,
yeah. No, that's unbelievable. And like, for people that aren't following the Saskatchewan Sport Fish Research Group on Facebook, there's times where, you post a picture of a lake, like a map of a lake, and you have, the red lines of where a fish has routed throughout your tracking process. And like I find that so interesting. Yeah. The routes and the amount of distance that these fish travel in a period of time is unbelievable. And for me, just following you guys on Facebook and seeing those images and like the distances. But like for me, when I see those images, I want to kind of know, like, well, why is this fish traveling so far?
Or not moving at all.
Or not moving at all. Like, you know what I mean? Is there any type of, like, do you, how in depth do your studies go on these fish that, you know, you route?
Yeah. So we desperately want to know the same thing. So
okay.
One of the things we're interested in was what parts of the lake are actually important to the fish, right? So Buffalo Pound's a great lake for studying because it's kind of easy to split up into little pieces. It's not a huge lake. Like, you know, even if you go to something like Last Mountain Lake, which is by Canadian standards, not a huge lake, but think of the area you have to cover there, right? Buffalo Pound's nice mm-hmm. and small. Yeah. It's not that deep. So it's a great, great lake to look at for logistic reasons. But so our question was, do they use all parts of the lake equally, or are there parts of it that fish actually prefer to use? And how does that relate to development on the lake? So, you know, you guys are familiar with Buffalo Pound. You know that it's got the potash mine. It's got some resort communities. It's got the provincial park, right? There's a bunch of sort of human usages of that lake. It's the source of drinking water for Moose Jaw and Regina. It's also the source of the embryos for the provincial stocking program. So there's a lot of human pressure on that lake. What do fish do in that lake, right? Do they split it up? Do they split it up at all? Is it all just one kind of bowl that they swim around in? You know, what do they do? That was what we were interested in. And so, you know, what motivates a fish to move or not move? And I kind of view it, I know this is not supposed to be an explicit show, but the, you know, think about the things that motivate animals, including us, to move, mm-hmm. right? And you can think about food, right? You can think about sex, and you can think about environmental conditions. So if I'm sitting in my lazy boy chair in the living room watching TV, and I got my bag of nachos, I've got the, you know, the heat or the air conditioning on, that's a pretty big component of keeping me happy and keeping me in that spot. Am I going to, what might make me get up to move if it's too hot or too cold, if I don't have food there? And of course, the third thing I mentioned, you know, seasonal movement for the pursuit of sex is another thing that will make fish move. So why are they moving in Buffalo Pound so much? I think most of the summer movement we're seeing is food based. They're probably chasing, the predatory fish are chasing prey around. And, you know, Buffalo Pound is not a very, diverse lake in terms of the type of structure that's available. And so you probably do have schools of bait fish moving, you know, from place to place, in that kind of open system. The other thing that Buffalo Pound, has is the water quality decreases over time in the open water season, right? So, you know, it gets greener, the dissolved oxygen content goes down, and probably the fish need to move to seek out places that have the right conditions for them. So I think when you combine all those things together, you got fish just bouncing around all over the place. And when you watch, Brandon, one of those reconstructions where it shows the animation of the movement and you look at the time scale, you know, it's like there are certain periods where they're not moving much at all. And all of a sudden, wham, they're all over the place, right? And I think it's it's a combination of that seasonal versus more local movement that you're seeing there. Now, why a fish decides, like we'll have these fish, you know, big pike, for example, they'll camp out for a while in a place in Buffalo Pound. And all of a sudden, they'll make a big trip all the way up, you know, past the Highway 2 Causeway, and they'll turn around and come right back again. And I have no idea what's going on in those trips. I really, really want to know, and I wish I had some great scientific theory for what's happening there, but it's just kind of a mystery. So, you know, with that, and that, what's good about that is that means that my job will never be obsolete.
Yes.
Yeah, no, for sure. No. I think what happened was they heard I was fishing the part of the lake they were in. So they just booked it. They left.
Just got out of there.
That's why I didn't catch anything.
Well, let's talk about that, Logan, because I think there's a kernel there that may actually be worth discussing for Buffalo Pound. So we had our receiver array out in the main part of the lake, and then in that basin to the northwest of the old Highway 2 Causeway, right? So people don't fish much in that back part there. You see the odd boat going through, and
this guy,
a ton of fish go back there. And you know, some of the fish seem to go back there and then disappear. So I think that the river upstream of Buffalo Pound is actually much more important than we had given it credit. So mm-hmm. And I think that's probably a water quality thing with, you know, the Qu'Appelle River there being released from Diefenbaker. It's probably colder and more oxygenated at times than the lake itself. So I think we're getting fish moving up into that area, seeking out those environmental conditions that are more suitable.
Yeah. And I know, like, me and Dad kind of had that theory that we've tested it as well, because as anyone knows, that fish is buffalo in the winter. The walleye population fishing is great in the summer. And vanishes. Then in the winter. Yeah. I mean, I figured out some things a little bit that usually can yield a couple of walleye in a day, but nothing like you kind of could get on the last mountain or something like that. And so we had that kind of in a bit talking to you or talking to Shayna, and then just kind of thinking about it. We're like, let's go try up there. Well, when you go there in January, February, the ice is 3 feet. You have another 3-4 feet of water below you. Like, it's not deep up there. So kind of difficult to target as an angler, but not difficult for those fish to be moving around there, right? So, I mean, I would agree with that as well. I mean, it makes sense, right? That that Diefenbaker water is a lot nicer too, coming into Buffalo than what Buffalo's water is. So
right. Well, this would be before Shayna's time, but we had carp and burbot that had acoustic transmitters on them that were in our first run at that receiver array study, and they disappeared. And so I was, I was incredulous. I couldn't believe it when the students were telling me the fish are gone. We can't find them. Right. And I said,
you're just not doing it right.
Yeah. Like, get out there in the boat with a hydrophone and do it manually. Right. They're just not showing up in the array for some reason. And of course they weren't there. So we actually had a grad student team up with some folks from the Water Security Agency, and they put a boat in at Tagaski on the Qu'Appelle River, and they floated downstream with the hydrophone in, and sure enough, that thing started beeping like crazy up just south of Tagaski, and that's where the carp were. So they had left the Buffalo Pound area altogether and swam, you know, tens of kilometers upstream. And then I was just completely blown away, because not only was I wrong that the students didn't look properly, but they were in a place where it just didn't make, you know, I just couldn't believe, especially carp, you know, which can tolerate a lot of relatively poor environmental conditions and are not specialized feeders. Why would they want to go all the way upstream? And I still don't know, Brandon, so I can't tell you why they move like that.
Yeah.
No, that's fine. I thought maybe I just wasn't scientific enough to, like, understand the posts. But no, like you mentioned, so carp, burbot, walleye, you know, you do so many pike, all these studies on different species and, you know, all the data. Is there any species that is, you know, your favorite to study, or what is the most interesting from a scientific aspect to study, I guess?
Yeah, so my favorite fish, it's kind of biased because it's also my favorite fish to fish for, is definitely burbot. From a scientific point of view, they are quite a different type of species. And so they're the only member of the cod family that is freshwater. All other members of the cod family are marine. And they are just so different in every way from any other species you can think of. Even to the point where, you know, they sing to each other during the spawn. And, you know,
really?
It's not a love song that we would really, you know, listen to and think, wow, that's romantic, but they do, they do vocalize and, you know, that they're the only,
what does that sound like?
It sounds like a series of thumps and croaks. So it's, like I said, it's not the most romantic sounding.
Sounds like something that would come from a burbot.
Yeah. it's basically, if you look at a burbot's face and try to imagine what it would sound like if it tried to talk, what it sounds like.
You know what? You know, so many people think they're just ugly and, you know, they're just, you know, garbage fish. And in the last couple of years, right, they've started to, you know, generate some love from the people, and now people just love them. And you know, you see pictures on social media of people just, you know, kissing burbot, and and you know, everyone loves to go target burbot nowadays. And it's, you know, for us, like, that's Logan's favorite species, and for us, we love a good burbot bite, whether that be on Diefenbaker, last mile lake, what have you. whatever your adventure might be, if you are looking for a boat to go fishing, hang out with the family, or maybe you're in the need of a quad, check out JP Adventure Rentals for all of your adventure rental needs.
Get your adventure on with JP Adventure Rentals in Saskatchewan. Whether it's remote ice fishing, hunting, trail riding, or just taking family and friends out for a day of fun, JP Adventure Rentals has you covered with brand new ATVs, snowmobiles, aluminum trailers, plus accessories. Visit jpadventurerentals.ca to make your reservation. Check out our sister company, Saskatchewan's Best Boat Rentals, for all of your boat rental needs. Pre-book now. Get out there with JP Adventure Rentals. We rent fun.
But I find it so interesting, and like watching some videos and stuff on, like, you know, obviously just recently, like, you know, not too long ago, they had their spawn, and you know, the type of spawn they have, where they have their big balls, and like, how, like, have you done any research into like burbot spawns or anything? Let's get into everything burbot. Let's talk about burbot.
The sad news is that they haven't been well studied really at all. There are some places where there are certain populations that people have collected a lot of data on, but broadly speaking, you know, for a fish that is found all over the Northern Hemisphere, including in Europe, they're really not that well studied. And I think something that, you sort of learn when you get a broader perspective is that the people who think burbot are trash and are ugly, you know, we used to have problems with folks in parts of Canada catching burbot and just leaving them on the ice to die, right? Yeah. Because they thought they were garbage and they were taking up space that more desirable fish would need. In the UK, so in England, for example, burbot were extirpated, and they are an endangered species that has been the subject of recovery programs that have been worth millions of dollars because they were once there, they were killed off, and now they want them back again. Right. So it's just, you know, beauty is always in the eye of the beholder in terms of how much you value a particular species. So I think, one of the things I really want to encourage people to do is to love burbot. Right. They're different looking. That doesn't mean they're ugly. I think actually quite cool looking, especially with those speckled patterns on them.
Yeah. But, the pattern.
So in terms of biology of burbot, I haven't had much of a chance to tackle basics, but what I am very interested in is catch and release biology, because there is virtually nothing known about how burbot respond to being caught and released. And they are predominantly caught through the ice. There's not much of a summer fishery for burbot, the odd accidental, you know, nighttime catch or, you know, something like that.
River catch.
Yeah. They don't show up that often in open water. So here you've got a species that is targeted in the winter, and it's also targeted at a sensitive time of year for it biologically, because it spawns under the ice, like you were just mentioning. And some of the hottest burbot bites that we get onto are those mating groups of fish, right? And so even if we're not harvesting them, if we're pulling them up, you know, enjoying a good catch and release day of burbot, how are they responding to that? And we don't know, even from a basic point of view, how well they survive catch and release, never mind any kind of disruption to the spawning behavior or habitat use or anything like that. So that's really where I've started, is to try to understand burbot catch and release. And we are doing that the same way we do with walleye, where we put a T-bar tag in them, and then we hope that anglers are going to catch them down the road, and we can figure out where they've moved and if they've survived, and you know how that's all playing out. The challenge for us is that it's such a short window compared to the other species. So if I tag a walleye today, I can't tag a walleye today because the season's closed, but let's say I tagged it on March 31st, right? It's going to have the entire open water and ice season in the next cycle to potentially get caught and reported by an angler. Burbot, you get that narrow kind of ice season only, right? And then not again until the next narrow ice season. So we don't get the same opportunity for recapture reports as we do with other species. So it's a bit more challenging that way. But over time, we're hoping to build up that picture of what's happening there.
Is there any insight on why they kind of, you know, aren't an open water fish?
Really,
you know,
disappear? I've seen
the odd one caught, you know, like last summer, a friend of mine caught like a high 20, midsummer. It's not too often you see a picture of a big burbot caught in the middle of summer. And like you said, it's very rare. But is there any scientific reason for that? Where do they go?
Yeah, so I'm tempted to believe that they migrate to the southern U.S. with, you know, like birds do, but they do some strange and wonderful things, burbot. So one of the things that they do is they actually burrow into the bottom of the lake. So they will have holes in the bottom of the lake that they go into. So they actually literally do disappear where you won't be able to see them. They also do something kind of similar in concept to hibernation, but opposite, where they try to ride out the warm summer season by basically being semi-dormant, hunkering down near the bottom of the lake, maybe inside of a burrow network, not doing much that's active. And if they are active, it's usually at night. And so if you're night fishing, you might have a better chance of getting that one-off capture of a burbot in the summer compared to just fishing during the day, where it doesn't happen quite as often. So I think what they're doing is basically trying to ride out suboptimal conditions, both temperature and light, by the summer, let's call it summer hibernation, for lack of a better term for it, where they're less active and, you know, what limited activity there is only going to happen when it's dark.
Right. Yeah. I think when Brandon said, where do they go? I was going to say, it's more, from what I've read and heard, at least, it's more of, they don't go anywhere. You said, it's they don't move. And am I correct in remembering that you did have one tag that you kind of saw didn't move at all?
We had, we tagged
the acoustic.
We put acoustic transmitters on a smaller number of burbot than the other species, because they're a little bit rarer in Buffalo Pound, but we did have five or six of them each year in all 3 years, which we tracked. Mm. And so we were putting the transmitter on in April and then tracking them potentially until October. What we saw across the board, except for one or two individual fish, was that those fish disappeared. They went up into the western basin by Highway 2, and we detected them as they left the receiver array, and then they were gone. So I think they're a river population that mostly goes up into the Capel River, kind of similar to what we were talking about before. There were a couple of fish, though, that went out into the main lake, and they kind of moved, you know, 5-6 kilometers to the southeast from where we tagged them up by Highway 2 there. And then they sat still for long periods of time. And I think those ones were doing more of that summer hibernation type behavior.
Okay.
And they were in the, Buffalo Pound, not known for its great depths, but the spots where it gets to, you know, 18-ish feet is where those burbot were hunkering down for the summer.
Right. And I think
in the depths.
Yeah. The deep depths. Yeah.
The deep depths of Buffalo Pound. I was going to say, like, when you mentioned that unfortunate part about, I hardly see it anymore. The most recent time I'd seen fish left on the ice was suckers at Buffalo a couple of years ago. But Dad has always told me, especially once I started talking about burbot more and he kind of remembered what they were, he said that they would see that a lot on the ice in the winter at Buffalo. He's been out there for a very long time as well. And he said they used to always see that was tons of burbot on the ice. So it almost makes me think the population used to be a lot better there. Maybe obviously not to the extent of what you're talking about in Europe and whatnot, but I've always kind of wondered, because you know they're in there. It's kind of, for me, it's connected to Deef. So obviously they can be in there, will be in there. And I tried so hard. I tried night fishing everything in the winter to land my first burbot there. And I was like, I want my first one to kind of be at the home lake of Buffalo Pound. And I actually did end up doing it when I was tip up fishing one day. I had a tip up out and was just jigging off a sandy point, kind of what you would target in another lake that did actually have depth, that sandy point for when they're going for the spawn. And I did end up catching about an 8-pounder. And so that's kind of where that whole love of the burbot started for me. But I guess same as you, I know you see the posts on Facebook of it seems to be like 4 or 5 you see on Facebook caught a year out there. Yeah. And it's just always kind of dumbfounded me how their camp just start to be more, unless it's like you said, water quality is changing or just things being different from back then, I guess, when my dad's stories took place. But
yeah, it's possible that you could have some resource partitioning of burbot in the lake too. So imagine a scenario where you have almost a lake population of burbot and a river population of burbot. And then historically, if the lake population was overexploited, you left fish on the ice to die, you kind of drive them down to a very low number. You know, you don't see them much in the main lake, but the river population is still there and still probably moving into that marshy area to spawn at the northwest corner of the lake. So, right. And maybe, you know, I've seen more reports of burbot, I think, in the last 2 years caught on Buffalo during the ice season than I have for a long time previous. So yeah. It's possible that they may be making a bit of a resurgence there. One of my big concerns about burbot is the possession limit in Saskatchewan, which to me,
we're on the same wave,
doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, so it's, yeah. It's eight fish and there's no size restriction. So if we go back to what we were talking about with this biology phenomenon where you've got your spawners that are being targeted, that's the heaviest bite, you know, the time when everyone's going out and targeting them. I sometimes see posts on social media where you've got guys lining up, you know, a large number of, you know, if you got four or five guys out and each guy can take eight fish, and you got these big females that they're taking out of the population right in the spawn. You know, if you were to ask a biologist, give me a recipe to reduce productivity in a population, they would say,
that's it.
Kill your gravid females. Right. And so my concern about that, even friends of mine, you know, a buddy of mine last year sent me a picture. He's like, yeah, the burbot bite's on. And it was a picture of his pickup truck, and him and three other guys had been out and they had kept their limit of these huge female burbot, and they'd lined them all up in the back of the pickup truck for the photo. It was a really cool photo, but all I could think about was, man, that's a lot of big female fish from one angling party that aren't going to make it to reproduce this year. So I do think that there is some room for improvement in the regulations for angling for burbot.
Yeah. And that's what we had an episode. Was it two episodes ago we talked about burbot?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So we kind of did a full episode with like some tips and kind of some things to catch them. But it was all when we started it, the first thing we said is they can be hard to find, but when you do find them, they're not hard to catch. So keep that in mind for being responsible when you are out there targeting them, because one, I mess up the math. I hadn't pointed that out yet on the podcast. I did terrible math for four people times eight, but I'm not going to try and do that again. But I was kind of like, you don't need that much in the first place, but it's just the size that these fish are compared to getting, say, eight perch, right? Or 10 perch that it is on Buffalo, I think now. It's like, it doesn't really make sense to me. And then like, a lot of that, you're freezing it. It's not going to be generally as good as when you first catch them. But yeah, that's the biggest thing for me is during the spawn, like the females made it to that point and just like in like the last minute, 10 minutes of say the spawn time, you're going out there and getting them. That's kind of disappointing to see. So we kind of also talked about kind of being mindful of the size that you're keeping, if you are going to keep, right? Like, because I think there has been a lot more, maybe respect is the right word for burbot, right? Not at near as many people see them as this garbage fish. They're predator, right? They get viewed as that, but then it's still stuck in the heads of lots of people that just keep all the ones you catch, especially the big ones. Whereas at least with walleye and pike, we've been able to kind of steer people away from that and letting the big ones go and reproduce and whatnot. But I think that's still a problem with the burbot.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that we will see a change in philosophy over time. I think as, you know, anglers, as a general rule, they adopt things. And then by word of mouth and by, you know, passing from father to son or from, you know, uncle to nephew kind of thing, or from, you know, mother to daughter, they pass on this information and it kind of spreads, takes on a life of its own. And I think we will see that happen with burbot. I just don't want it to take too long. So yeah. I think in the meantime, as a tool to accelerate that process, a change in the daily possession limit would send a message that, you know, people need to think about burbot in the same light as every other species when it comes to harvest. Yeah. So,
yeah, especially when we had Gord Pizer on for two episodes and so many people view the limit as a target, and he kind of talked about limiting or try to limit your possession instead of limiting it out, right? So what did he say exactly? What was the phrase that he had?
Catch your limit, but limit your catch.
Yeah, essentially. And so that's what I've kind of, that's, I mean, I hardly ever keep fish as it is. I've never kept a limit before, maybe sometimes I didn't have a choice because I couldn't catch anything, but it's kind of, it's, that's never been something I've done. And for so many people, like you said, like things getting handed down, father to son, daughter to, or mother to daughter, good things being handed down. Lots of times it's your grandfather got you into fishing and your goal was to limit out 2 hours into the morning and go home, right? Like that's some other things that are being passed down. So I think that's where kind of for like something like this, or just people that really like the sport have that responsibility to try and voice some of that stuff for helping with that. And I think that's a really good point of kind of, you'll hopefully start to see some changes with those limit numbers, because it'll show people that, hey, like this is something to keep an eye on, and it's not necessary that you maybe have eight every time you go out.
Right. And I do think that as anglers, you know, we're getting ever more sophisticated in terms of how we locate fish and then how we target them and get them to bite. And I have read some editorial pieces by Gord Pizer where he talks about this and basically makes a case that anglers need to voluntarily shut down when, you know, when decide when is a good fishing day. And even if you're catching and releasing, say that, you know, okay, I've caught 20 fish today. Maybe that's good enough. Yeah. And I think that is definitely the case for burbot, because if you do get onto a hot spot, you know, you could plow through 20, 30 burbot in a day pretty easily, even if you're releasing them without knowing how they respond to catch and release. You know, it's kind of it's a crapshoot as to what happens to them after we put them back down the hole. Now, my hope is that it's cold water, they're a tough fish, and, you know, the fight is not that long, that they're just swimming away and there's very, very high survival rate. But without knowing that, you know, if we assume, you know, the angler's guide in Saskatchewan says the background rate of mortality for catch and release is 10%. You know, for every 10 fish that you catch, one of them is going to die. You know, by the time you've caught 50 fish at the end of the day, you've taken another five out of the population, if that 10% holds. So, I do think there's a whole segment of ethical angling there where even for catch and release, you need to limit your influence on fish populations.
Right. And yeah, we didn't even talk about it in our burbot episode, but lots of the time you see it at deef too, the way that there's the change in depths. Like, I know it's hard to dictate, like a fish could easily come from 40 when you're fishing in 25, especially on deef, and you wouldn't know. But like lots of times those burbot are being targeted right on that, I guess, imaginary line that we have for barotrauma.
That threshold.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because barotrauma is another subject of mine so we often think about barotrauma. So this is, you know, the damage to tissue that results from rapid decompression of a fish as you bring it up from depth, right? And the 30 feet is kind of the magical line we all draw, and we say, you know, if I'm fishing at 30 feet or shallower, I'm good. And there's nothing magical about 30 feet. It happens to be the depth at which the atmospheric pressure, you're at double the atmospheric pressure, basically. So the pressure at 30 feet is double what it would be at the surface. And we kind of use it as a guideline to say, you know, you shouldn't go deeper than that, because anything more than double the surface pressure is too much of a change for the fish. And, you know, some species still respond with barotrauma symptoms even at 25 feet. You know, you catch the odd fish where you pull it up from 25 feet and it's got the distended swim bladder and it can't resubmerge properly. And as you're saying, you're fishing on a shelf or a drop and you're at 30 feet, but the fish is coming up from 60 feet to take that bait. You know, that's a fish that's going to have a major change in pressure and rapid decompression by the time you get it to the surface. And I've seen some burbot at ice fishing tournaments that were in that kind of environment where they have what's called catastrophic decompression of the swim bladder, where the swim bladder actually bursts. And the air from the swim bladder ends up underneath the skin, and they actually get it up like underneath the pectoral fins. It looks like they're wearing water wings, basically. That fish is basically toast, right? Its swim bladder is burst. It has air distributed all throughout its body cavity that's not supposed to be there. It can't resubmerge, and it's got a lot of tissue damage, but it's still alive at that moment, but it's basically done. So barotrauma is, I think, one of the big challenges for catch and release fishing in freshwater. It hasn't received nearly as much attention as saltwater fish. So I think of your reef fish, you know, rockfish or grouper, snapper, fish that you catch in deep water in the ocean. Tons of barotrauma research on those types of species. Walleye, almost nothing. right? And they're very susceptible to barrow trauma, as I'm sure most anglers have seen at some point, right? So so there's a real important gap there that needs some definite research and some best practice recommendations. And we have been trying to do some of that work, but it's a slow slog. We're still working on it.
Right. Because I guess to do that work, you need barrow trauma fish, right?
Correct.
Okay. So yeah.
I can either go out and induce the barrow trauma myself, which I'm reluctant to do, or we can work with tournament fish that come in with barrow trauma symptoms. And that's the approach we've been taking to try to figure out, you know, how much barrow trauma is too much barrow trauma. And honestly, I find walleye to be pretty wimpy when it comes to barrow trauma. Like they're, you know, when they have an inflated swim bladder, they're very, very terrible at resubmerging compared to some other species.
Right. Yeah. I kind of agree with you there. They kind of seem to be, when you do see that a lot, it's usually not a very good outcome. And I think, I know we talked before we started recording about there's a matter of scientific opinion and personal opinion. But I think one thing that people are kind of interested in, I know in talking to you or some of the students you've had, there's not as much info on it, but like when it comes to fizzing, right? That's something that I think a lot of people just, oh, I got the fizz needle, I'll be good to go. So I don't know if would you want to speak on that, at least from a opinion standpoint, or?
Yeah, so we actually have done some formal studies on this, and we actually did a really cool study where we took fish in three categories. So, and this is from Last Mountain Lake, and this was in collaboration with the Last Mountain Fall Walleye Classic. Really, really excellent tournament to partner with for research. Always been very supportive. You know, it's one of these things where you ask tournament organizers, can you do research? And, you know, if you find something that is potentially negative about tournaments, that can kind of turn around on you. And never had that issue with any of the tournament organizers in Saskatchewan. So I think it's just worth a plug.
That's to fantastic. Say that.
Yeah. But anyway, that tournament takes place in the Rowan's Ravine area, and there's some seriously deep water in that area of the lake. And there's some fish that come in with barrow trauma symptoms. And so it's a place where we can get access to fish that have moderate to severe barrow trauma, fish that are normal, that don't have any barrow trauma, and everything kind of in between. So what we did, we went back to those acoustic transmitters. We took fish in three categories, ones that we fizzed, ones that we descended using a weighted descending device, which is another approach to treating barrow trauma. So you take your fish and you attach a weight to it temporarily, you descend it back down to a deep depth, and then you pop the weight off. So it basically returns it back to a depth of neutral buoyancy and the pressure that it came from in one fell swoop. And then we had fish that were non-barrow trauma, that were just caught in shallower water, that didn't have symptoms. And so we put transmitters on all these guys, and we tracked them for 7 days intensively following the tournament. And then we went back again at around 20 days, and then at around 60 days to find these guys. And it turns out that there's some really, really interesting results to report. So one is that we had a professional fizzing tool, which we were able to sterilize and, you know, wield very carefully. And all of the fish that we fizzed survived and moved after the tournament. And they were still around, you know, a month after the tournament. So we know that they, you know, they made it. All the descended fish survived and all the control fish survived. So everybody survived, basically. What was interesting was that the fish that were fizzed had completely different movement patterns, different habitat use, and different depth profiles than the other fish. And they used shallower water. They used different parts of the lake. They were kind of closer to shore than the other ones were. And when you think about it, it kind of makes sense. We basically fizzed them and took away their ability to regulate their buoyancy, and therefore took away the normal way that they would select what depth they're going to be at in the lake. And so they immediately went to places where it was more shallow and where they probably felt a little bit safer than being out in the open water. In retrospect, when I look back on that, I think the problem is that we fizzed them too well. And what I mean by that is that the key to fizzing is a clean fizzing device. So you're not spreading infection or, you know, sticking the fish with rust or something along those lines. And the other is the land marking. And what I mean by that is, where do you insert the needle, right? That makes all the difference in the world, right? So imagine if I'm an angler who maybe knows a little bit about fishing, but not that much. And I start jabbing the needle in, right, until I find the spot where the air starts to come out. And we actually get fish that come in at weigh stations where they have 3-4 fishing holes in the abdomen. And some of those have blood coming out of them. If you poke a needle into a fish to fizz it and blood comes out, that's a really bad sign, right? Because that means you hit something that isn't the swim bladder. And that's where I think the real trouble might come, is when you hit organs that are not the swim bladder. That causes injury, but it also introduces the possibility for infection and the fish maybe dying down the road from a bacterial infection in the body cavity. So,
yep.
So back up to your question, Logan. So what do I think of fizzing? I think fizzing is a perfectly valid concept. And if it is done properly, it can work quite well.
Right.
If it is done in a sloppy fashion, using an inappropriate tool, or if it's used as a crutch to give people this kind of almost permission to fish in deep water, I think that's where we get into trouble. So
right.
I like the idea of fizzing as an emergency tool, where you're the guy who's fishing in 25 feet and a walleye streaks in from 60 feet and takes your bait and you didn't know that. What do you do when you have this bloated fish up at the surface? Either you keep it or you try an emergency treatment like fizzing. And that should be something that happens, you know, once in a blue moon. It shouldn't be that you target fish in 60 feet of water every Saturday and you fizz 30 fish every weekend. I think that's not going to go anywhere good.
Yeah. So kind of more of a life-saving measure in Absolutely. A sense, as opposed to a daily occurrence.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And same with descending. Descending works. It's a little more foolproof in my mind, because you don't need to poke a hole in the fish. When you're doing descending, there's no way you're going to jab the needle through the fish's liver or something like that. And if you descend the fish and it doesn't go all the way down, it pops off and comes back up, you can just do it again. It's not like fishing where you poke a hole, it's in the wrong spot. Now I need to poke another hole, right? And every time I poke a hole in the fish, that's a potential long-term injury. And then descending also takes care of other tissue damage, right? Where, you know, when the fish comes up from deep depth, the swim bladder is just the most obvious symptom of barotrauma, right? And we can see it,
right?
And it prevents the fish from submerging and makes it float belly up. But other organs are affected by that pressure change, right? The eyes, the blood vessels, you know, lots of the organs in the body cavity all experience that traumatic decompression. When you put a fish back down with a descending device, it fixes all of that all at the same time. Whereas when you fizz a fish, it's just the swim bladder that gets addressed.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense, yeah, but it's probably something that no one thinks of, right?
Yeah, because we kind of go by what we see, right? And you see you see the belly up fish, you see the bloated belly. You know, you flick the belly, it sounds like a drum. We can take care of that with a fizzing needle right away. And here's the kicker: I spent all that time doing that study on behavior after post release. We know the fish are not going as deep anymore, so you fizz them and you take care of that swim bladder. But they don't even return to the same deep depths that they were at before, because they can't regulate their buoyancy anymore. So that other damage that they experience
never gets fixed.
Yeah, or it might take longer to get fixed. Yeah. Huh.
So really, then, descending device is greater than fizzing needle, in a sense, for that.
Yeah, it's so. Again, we talked about the difference between kind of opinion and science. The outcome from the science suggests that they both work. Right. My personal opinion, and opinion based on actually wielding them in the field, is that the descending device is more foolproof. Right. It's easier to use. It's less invasive. It takes care of all the problems in one fell swoop. And you can carry the descending device in your tackle box, and you don't have to worry about it being sterile. You don't have to worry about it being rusty. You know, it's just you just attach it to the fish's face temporarily and it goes down and everything is good. So I prefer it for a whole list of reasons. But I, you know, part of that is scientific and I know that it works, but the other parts of it are more, sort of what you feel when you're trying to wield the tools in the field.
Right. And I think that's an important thing to talk about, because I know we had Doug on, who runs the Last Mountain Fall Walleye Classic, and he was kind of talking about, like, I mean, I don't know how you would regulate it in a tournament, but there's money on the line. Lots of guys might do things a little differently than they do in their regular fishing, right? They might be willing to push that limit of how deep they go. And I know it, like sportsmanlike and stuff like that, you'd want to stay away from that 30 feet. And I know pretty well every boat in those tournaments does have a fizzing device. So I do agree with you in the sense that people are like, I got the device, I can probably push it a little more, right? And to me, I agree with you. It should be seen as a last resort. It's something that you don't want to have to use. You don't want to make yourself have to use that. So I think that's interesting. I also like it because I didn't really know what opinion to have on it, because I kind of heard that people had them and lots of people like, oh, you fizz it, it's fine. But it was kind of like, there's been lots of stuff like that where people say, oh, just do this, it's fine, when it's really not, because we learn better, right? But that's nice to know. Makes me have a different opinion on those devices, because I really didn't know for sure if that was just guys talking or if there was something behind it.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that's really important to keep in mind too is that as anglers, we often have this feeling based on what we see the fish do as it swims out of our hands, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, I'll hear from anglers that, yeah, I released a fish, it went really nice, looked really good, and that doesn't mean anything to me anymore. So and yeah, I'll tell you why, because we sometimes have fish that swim away and you're like, okay, good, that fish is looking really great, I feel really good about that release.
Strong release,
yeah, vigorous release, and it dies. You know, we had yeah, fish that were released with radio transmitters on them. Yeah, they swim away vigorously, and you're like, yeah, looks great. Even our scoring system, we actually have a numeric scoring system for behavior on release, shows that they swam away like a normal, healthy fish. And then we find them floating dead 48 hours later. So mm-hmm, they have what's called delayed mortality, right? And fizzing gives you that sense of confidence in your release, because a fish that you put in the water and it floated belly up, you fizz it and all of a sudden now it swims away. And it may be because you've corrected the problem and the fish is fine, or it may be that you've just given the fish the ability to sink and be out of sight when something else happens to it. And
out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. And I think that that's a lot of where that opinion about fizzing comes from, is that the fish used to be floating belly up and was obviously not going to make it. Now I don't mm-hmm, see it anymore. There's a chance it could be fine, right?
Right.
And if you talk to yourself enough, you can convince yourself that, okay, yeah, it's fine. Right.
Right.
So it turns out that, yeah, they may be fine, but it's really hard to say with 100% certainty unless you have really good data showing that that is the case.
Okay. So I kind of had two questions off of that. Of the one, when you, because you said you studied them for a certain amount of time after, is that they're now permanently unable to regulate that, or does that hole that was created eventually heal and they're able to do it again? And then the other question I kind of had regarding that is, I guess when you do get that fizz, or no, not when you get the fizz, sorry, when it is actually sticking out of their mouth, that's the bladder as well, right?
Yeah. So what you're seeing out of their mouth is actually not the bladder, it's the stomach.
So, oh, that's the stomach.
Yeah. Okay. So the swim bladder blows up so big that it pushes the organs out of the, up the throat of the fish. So,
wow.
So what you're seeing there is the stomach turned inside out and sticking out from the front. So
are those ones pretty well done? Or is that?
So we don't, I can't say for sure, because as I mentioned, walleye are kind of, they're wimpy. They're really susceptible to barotrauma effects. We never get them alive in that condition. So we've had some fish with, you know, with the really popped out eyes. You know, the eyes will pop out of the skull, basically. And
I've heard of that. Yep.
They almost always die. So we don't get a chance to see if the correction measure actually fixes them, because they die very shortly after we get them. And I have had some perch with organ inversion, where they have the stomach in the mouth, and we've descended them, and I haven't had any recaptures of them. It's just a small group of fish, so it's most likely mm-hmm, they just, you know, the probability of recapturing a handful of perch is not very good, right? So so I guess the honest answer there is I don't know if those ones are done or not. But for walleye, my feeling would be that if it's that severe, they're probably not gonna make it.
Okay. See, and I've never, you know, heard of anybody or personally seen when that happens to a walleye. I've never seen the stomach, you know, come through the mouth. For me, I've seen one perch that that's happened to. And to me, when you see that, first instinct is this fish is dead. If I release it, it's not going to survive. So I ended up keeping that one perch. And that's the only time I've ever seen that happen. And I didn't even realize, you know, that obviously can happen to walleye and other species as well, but I've only ever seen it in perch.
Yeah. So, a couple of times I've been to conferences in the US and, participated in catch and release symposia where there, you know, there's folks working on grouper and rockfish and things like that on the coast.
Yeah.
And they're fishing in 300 plus feet of water, which, you know, mm-hmm. is crazy by our experience here. And they'll bring up these fish that are almost unrecognizable. Like they're completely blown up. The stomach is out of the mouth. The eyes are popped out of the head. They have hemorrhaging from the, you know, and they'll descend them and videotape it with a camera in the line, right? And as the fish gets down and the pressure starts to increase again, the symptoms will start to reverse, right? And then they'll get down to the bottom and they'll shake the fish off and it'll kind of, you know, sort of shake itself and it'll swim away. And, you know, people were curious, do they actually live? And the answer is sometimes, right? Sometimes the damage is too much and they die later. In the ocean, they often face this problem that there's always a bigger predator around. So you take a fish that's all messed up from barotrauma and you put it back down in that habitat and a shark's going to come and eat it. We don't have sharks in Saskatchewan or in other freshwater fisheries. So we might have a leg up that way. So maybe they might have a better chance in freshwater.
Right.
So, but definitely need more information on it.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a better chance than them in the boat.
Yeah. At least, so their chance is zero when they're on the barbecue. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I guess, do you know if like once you visit, is that air bladder done or can that heal?
Oh, sorry. I was supposed to get to that. I was going around a roundabout route to get to that question. So the answer is yes, the air bladder does heal and it actually heals quite quickly. So in lab studies of fish, you're looking at 7 to 10 days. And in our field study of fish at around day 7, the behavior of the fish started to go back towards more normal.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So they definitely do heal. And relatively speaking, the hole is pretty small. Now, the one thing that I would maybe think would be a good time to think about would be seasonality, right? So in the summer, when the water's warm and your fish metabolic rate is high, that hole is going to close quickly. What if you fizz a fish in the ice fishing season and the water's only 2 degrees? You know, it might take much longer for that same injury to heal. So
right,
no, that's very fair.
No, that makes sense. I guess we've had you for an hour here, so I think we did have some questions from Instagram and whatnot that people had on the story. But
sure, I'm sorry I talk too much when you get I get excited. I get excited. I start talking about stuff.
You know, this is fantastic.
I think I probably talked to you for multiple hours and whatnot. But
let's make this a two episode interview.
Yeah, we could do that because we're already an hour and whatnot. But I kind of wanted to get my own question in first before we went to some of those. I've been lucky enough, I think, to catch 2 or 3 walleye that the group has tagged. One of them was they're all in Buffalo, but one was actually a reward one. So I got a T90, the lake trout bait.
$100,000 check.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I got that and I think a blade bait, but then 2 other ones. I was kind of wondering, like I fish Buffalo quite a bit and I know the tagged fish are in there, but how often are you getting emails? Like, is it weekly or whatnot of people catching these tagged fish?
In the summertime, it's multiple per week.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And on weekends, some weekends we might get 20.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah. So it's, there's a lot of tagged fish out there and there's a lot of anglers out there and, you know, kudos to the anglers that they're so interested in it and that they, take the time out to submit things. But yeah, it's there's a lot of tag reports coming in. Now the ice fishing season is much slower. We don't get as many tag returns during that time of year, but definitely during the summer, we're getting them, I'd say almost on a daily basis. And then each weekend that goes by, we get quite a few.
And I guess how often are people keeping those fish? Like for me, my general thought is I see that tag and that fish is marked to go back in the water for sure. Even if I was more of a keep fisherman, I for me, that'd be like, this is your golden ticket. You've got this get out of jail free card on you from now on. Once you have that tag and you can be put back. Like, how often are people saying they're keeping them?
Yeah. So interestingly, we don't say much about this one way or the other. If people want to keep a tag fish, they're welcome to keep it. It's, if it's, you know, mm-hmm. legally harvestable. The, interesting thing about it is it seems to completely depend on where the fish is caught. So, some lakes like Madge Lake, for example, in Duck Mountain, almost 100% of the fish that are caught there are eaten. Oh. So anglers just don't release them, with the tags on them or not. So, you know, it's, I don't know what it is about, if it's people that are there for vacation and they're like, oh, I'm keeping a fish for a fish fry no matter what, or, mm-hmm. or, you know, how that works.
Yeah.
Alternatively, you go to places like Last Mountain Lake, Buffalo Pound, Diefenbaker, the release rate is much higher. About 70-75% of the fish are released. Oh, so, nice. So there's still a few being kept, but, the majority are being released. And what I like about that is that it gives us the opportunity for multiple recaptures. And right. So you guys may know from following the Facebook group that we have fish that are now caught up to 5 times, which is just mind-blowing to me.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It is mind-boggling.
Yeah. They don't learn.
Or how much they move, too, or like the time. It, like, wasn't like some of the walleye were like within a day or two of each other, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And they, you know, sometimes they're caught quite rapidly right after their tag, so a day, you know, a day later. And then sometimes... you know, they're caught a day later and 24 kilometers away, which is, mm-hmm. it's pretty crazy. So
that's awesome.
That's wild. But, and like, for those of you listening too, if you don't know, if you are fishing in Saskatchewan and you catch a fish with a tag in it, it'll have all the information on the tag that you can, you know, reach out to Chris, and whether that be via email, we'll have his email down in the show notes below, or, you know, the Sport Fish Research Group on Facebook, you know, reach out and report that information. And that's going to help their program out a lot. So,
yeah, thank you for that plug. And we also, view it very much as an exchange of information. So anglers send me the info, on the capture, and I send them whatever we have in our database and say, you know, where the fish was captured, under what conditions, what our assessment showed about it, and then, you know, where it was released. And they have a chance to see that, okay, that's kind of cool. I caught it. It was released at Regina Beach, and I caught it up at Rowan's Ravine. So it's, you know, it's kind of moving around a little bit, and everybody learns a little bit that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, no, even the one I caught, before, like, me and Brandon both fished our first tournament last year, which was the Buffalo Pound tournament. But the one I sent you, I caught it at the Causeway in the fall, I believe, just this fall. And you let me know that it was tagged as part of the 2017 tournament at Buffalo Pound. And I was like, well, that's pretty cool, because I volunteered to help at that tournament and was running fish from the station to the docks and whatnot, and helping out with stuff there. So I was like, that's kind of cool. Like, I was there when this fish was tagged at the launch, and now I ended up catching it.
You probably touched that fish in 2017.
I might have.
Well, I know what's really cool. I actually had an angler this past year. He caught a tagged fish, I believe it was 2 years ago, reported it, and then 2 years later caught the same tagged fish and reported it. And he didn't realize it was the same number until he sent me the email, and I looked at the database, and I was like, oh, look at that. It looks like, so then I emailed him back and confirmed all the info. And sure enough, he actually caught the same tagged fish twice with a 2 year gap in between. So
that's and crazy. The odds of that are like slim to none.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And so, yeah, there's a lot of personal connections there. Lots of people have very strong personal connections to the fish and to the lake that they're fishing. And I think mm-hmm. they really get some valuable information out of, you know, understanding that A, the fish are living to get recaptured another day, and B, you know, how much do they move and where do they go? And it's just, there's a lot of, like I said, anglers are biologists. They can't escape it. And so they like mm-hmm. that information. And I think it's a great two-way communication type of program.
Yeah. And I think you're right with that, is it kind of does give it another purpose. Like, fishing is fun, love fishing, but like, now Saskatchewan has the Master Angler program. That's another, you're hoping for a massive angler now when you go out, right? Or in some of these bodies of water that you have tagged fish in, maybe I'll catch a tagged fish today, right? Like, maybe it'll be my lucky day. So it kind of just adds another layer on top of something that we already love to do. Now there's like bonuses, I guess, that you can get while you're out there.
Yeah. And there's some guys that that really do seem to attract tagged fish. They'll get multiples. Like you're saying, Logan, you caught two or three. That's pretty good. I have some guys that have caught 10 tagged fish.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just, it's pretty incredible.
So I got some work to do.
Yeah, you
got
to catch up.
Yeah. I'll just fish. I'll strictly fish buffalo this year on tagged fish.
Hunt, I don't know if that's going to help you. So buffalo is that we tag a fair number of fish in Buffalo, but it's one of the lower recapture sites that we have. And I think it's because of whatever the mystery is involved with walleye. They disappear. And they disappear. It's a
mystery lake.
Yeah. I guess one thing I thought about, it kind of, I have a ton of questions because it's Buffalo and where I grew up, but you talk about heading up northwest, but what about southeast down the other end? Is that, has there been anything there?
We haven't seen any fish directly go that route. I've had a couple of fish disappear at that southern end, and we assume that they left by the exit by the Nickel Flats Dam there. But I can't 110% confirm it just because we didn't actually observe them go.
Right.
I did take the hydrophone down there and put it in the river to see if I could pick them up below the dam, but I didn't get them. So
nothing. They might have met the pelicans at the bottom of the fish ladder at the dam there.
Yeah, that would be the shark equivalent in our system. So
about 10 of them at all times right there. We hope you guys enjoyed that part one of the interview there with Chris Summers. We were so happy to have him sit down and get to pick his brain. So many questions and so much knowledge that he had to give us. And we know that he loves to be able to talk about it and tell people. I think it's pretty cool that we know that lots of this research is going on, and the way that the Facebook page is able to portray that information and kind of actually show you not just numbers or stuff like that. Like, they actually will show you what's going on and what they're finding. So I think I really enjoyed part one there, and I hope everyone else did. But what was your favorite part, Brandon?
Man, there's so many. Like, there's just so much information, and you know, things that, you know, a weekend warrior or an average angler doesn't take into consideration, that, you know, is a different thought process from a science perspective. But more or less, like, just the whole tagging aspect of it is so interesting, and the technology that they use to track these fish, and, you know, they're able to, you know, route, see where fish are going and the distances that these fish are traveling. It's just, it's mind blowing. And, I mean, for me, like, there was a lot of information there in episode one of this interview, and episode two is a little bit of Q&A from our listeners, you guys. And there's more information in that episode. So if you enjoyed this one, definitely keep your eyes peeled. Episode two of this interview is going to drop in 2 weeks. And it's filled with information.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I guess we got, as we mentioned at the top of the episode, for sure wanted to mention 13 Fishing again. They've come on as the presenting sponsors, and just recently, like we've been mentioning, their code that they've supplied us with is now for the whole website. It's not just 13 Fishing anymore, so you can save 50% off on all their brands that they have on the website there. You can literally go jigs, baits, rods, reels, clothes. Like, there's everything you need to get out there, even tools. I was looking at their tools. Like, I have a smaller live well on my boat. Not that I keep as much, but I plan to fish the Buffalo Pound Tournament this year, and we'll probably use my boat. Well, they've got a floating aerator, battery powered, that I can just toss in there. I think it's like $30, $35. That's going to help, right? Just tools like that. They've got a lot of awesome stuff on there. So be sure to check that out. Use the code, save 15%. I think it's awesome. Anytime you can save money on fishing stuff, right? Take advantage of it. So I guess without further ado, thank you for tuning into this episode. Like Brandon said, part two will be coming in the next 2 weeks. We hope you enjoyed it, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to the Weekend Warriors Fishing Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to leave a review on your favorite listening platform so we can reach more anglers just like you. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube for media updates and behind-the-scenes content.